For me, when I went to work every morning or you're sitting in the Oval Office, really the focus at that moment and at that time is on your job. What are you going to say? What are the arguments going to be? I'm not necessarily looking around the table thinking I'm the only woman here. I kind of got used to it and I really just stopped thinking about it and I just tried to focus on doing my job.
Welcome to What Unites Us, a podcast about building businesses meant to last. We're your hosts, Taylor Justice and Esther Farkas. We lead Unite Us, a technology company that connects health and social care.
We became curious about the way other leaders develop, innovate, inspire, and lead to drive change. We've invited an incredible lineup of visionaries to share their experiences, whether they created a new industry, turned an existing one on its head, or breathed new life into an old brand.
We're glad you're here. Thanks for tuning in. All right, team, our guest today is Seema Verma. She was the former administrator for Medicare and Medicaid services for almost 4 years, managed a gazillion dollar budget, and actually gazillion is probably too low,
yeah.
$1.5 trillion. And in this role, she had a responsibility for 145 million beneficiaries, 6,000 employees, and another 100,000 contractors. Seema was also named the most influential person in healthcare in 2019 and obviously helped carry the country through COVID. So we are very excited to welcome you to the show and appreciate your time.
Thank you. It's great to be with you.
We have a lot of folks that listen to the podcast that have no idea about healthcare. They come from the community, they come from other government agencies, and obviously we have a bunch of provider systems and plans. But I would say the vast majority really don't understand healthcare and its complexity. Can you explain at an elementary level, what is CMS and what does it do?
Well, I think many of us know the Medicare program, right? That provides healthcare coverage to people over 65 and disabled individuals. So we run that program. We also run the Medicaid program, and the Medicaid program is operated by the states, but CMS is the federal agency over all of the Medicaid programs. And so just between those two programs, and then the third big program in coverage is in the individual market, the tax credits. Those are the Obamacare exchanges. So those are the three major delivery programs. And between those three programs, it's about 145 million people, which is almost half of Americans that are on these programs. And then I think people don't understand this part of the agency, but we also set all of the quality and safety standards for pretty much every healthcare institution in the country. So whether that is a hospital or a dialysis facility or nursing homes or hospice, all of those standards and oversight happens at CMS. And then the last area is we actually have an innovation center. As we all know, our healthcare is very expensive, and this innovation center is dedicated to kind of figuring out how do we change the way we pay for healthcare and how do we improve quality. So those are sort of the big major areas of CMS.
So we're in election season. Healthcare is always a topic in debates. You get on Twitter and you see the Amazons and the Googles that took their shot within the healthcare arena as well and had varying levels of success, and some just left the industry altogether. But you see a lot of folks that are in healthcare that talk about, oh, these big tech companies want to come into healthcare and they just don't understand how hard it is. There's almost a sense of pride at times, I feel like, from the healthcare arena of how complicated it really is. And at times, I feel like it's all these really, really smart people that are trying to be smarter than the next person. And they all have like their little component and they make it so difficult and it doesn't work with the other person's very difficult piece. Like, why is healthcare so complicated?
I think part of the reason why it's complicated is it's highly regulated, right? It's regulated because almost a third of the market is Medicaid and Medicare. And then you have the additional complexity of that regulation over the actual healthcare facility. So it's not that easy to do things. The other thing is that healthcare combines a lot of disciplines, right? There's a big legal component to it because it is so highly regulated, not just at the federal level, but the states have their own set of rules. you have, there's the science component of it, right? Where those are the folks that are coming up with cures and treatments and doctors, and they're the scientific side of it. But then there's a big financial piece of this as well, where there is so much money. It's almost a third of our economy. You know, I'd say it's probably about a third of the federal budget as well. It's larger than the entire Department of Defense, to give you some perspective of how much money we're spending on it. So there's a lot of politics involved, because you try to make any type of change, you know, you're disturbing the apple cart. And so there's the political component, financial, legal, scientific. So there's all these different disciplines that kind of come into place. And then technology is also a huge component as well, where technology is trying to make it easier for healthcare. But when they come in, they're also then under that regulatory structure, the financial structure, the politics, and the policy as well.
Yeah. And as also a child of immigrants who wanted her to become a doctor and didn't become one, how did you get here? And tell us a little bit about your path to this and the path to public service ultimately.
I think our stories always start with our parents' story. My parents were immigrants. My dad came to the United States in the 60s during the civil rights movement, went back, married my mom. They had an arranged marriage, and they come to the United States literally with just a couple of suitcases. And they don't have the backdrop or the safety net of a family structure. And it really is just do or die type of survival for them. But they came over with the idea of the American dream. They really felt strongly about that. That's why they were here. And they were clearly making a lot of sacrifices just by being so far away. So, you know, I think for us being the children of immigrants, they had a lot of high expectations, and they weren't always able to achieve the dreams that they wanted to achieve. And so they kind of instilled it into us. I think a lot of Indian immigrants are very drawn to medicine. And it's likely because they really saw it as something that was a sure bet, right? If you work hard, you get the grades, you get those MCAT scores, you're going to get into med school, and you're kind of guaranteed a certain lifestyle, a certain income. And they dissuaded us from other professions because they thought that those were, they were more political, they were more based on relationships. And they were like, we don't have that. We don't have connections. We don't have relationships. We don't know anybody. And if you choose that path, it'll be a lot harder. So broke my mother's heart when I said, I don't want to go to med school, love these biology classes, but the physics and chemistry, not so much fun. And when I was in college, got interested in student government. And we had some great leaders there, and our group got to do a lot of neat things. And so I started to become interested in public policy, and eventually went to finish a degree in public health, where I focused on policy and management in healthcare. And never regretted that decision, because when it comes to healthcare, there's no dearth of issues and problems that need to get solved. And it's continuous learning. It takes a lot of creativity to solve problems, but that complexity, I think I actually enjoy.
Let's talk about that a little bit too, because the complexity is one thing, but the complexity at the level that you were at, the visibility that you had in a market where, as you mentioned, there's all these different forces. There's financial, there's politics, there's intellectual feelings, and those feelings are very strongly held across work experiences. You know, we talked about tech companies trying to come into healthcare. Walk through the experience of becoming the administrator. Like, how does it happen? It's not like you're getting on Indeed and uploading your resume and hoping they pick you up.
Did you get a call at midnight?
Yeah.
Did you get a call that was like, this is it?
For me, I had started my own consulting company. And in the process of that, I had been working with a lot of states and companies, and was actually pretty frustrated with the way things were moving in our healthcare system. I'm not a big believer in big government, and I felt like we were moving to even more government, even more regulation, which we know hasn't worked, and yet we were doing more of it. And so I became interested in getting more involved. And also by this point in my career, I had worked on the local level, I had worked on the state level, and really saw that, okay, here's the next step, which is the federal level. And so there's an election going on. I started working on the Trump campaign. And for them, it was all focused on Obamacare. Worked on the campaign for a little while. And then people always think that it was my relationship with the vice president. He's from Indiana. I'm from Indiana. We had worked together quite a bit. I had put together his healthcare plan. So we had a very good relationship, and he kind of helped me get connected to the campaign, and it went from there. And so when we won that night, I knew that there would be the question of, do you want to come and work for the administration? It's a very tough decision. You know, I had two kids, one in high school and one in junior high. And you know, no matter what, there really is not that work-life balance. You are clearly putting family on the back burner for a certain period of time. So that was probably the hardest decision for me. So the interview process was actually pretty quick and pretty smooth because of the work that I had done previously. We had put together the plan for the Pence team, and his healthcare plan was then accepted by the Obama administration. So I think that I had the reputation of actually being able to work on both sides of the aisle, work in a bipartisan way, and come up with creative ideas. And so had an interview with the president, and this was right before Thanksgiving. I think I ended up being the seventh person that was nominated because healthcare was such a priority. And walk into the interview, and the president, I'd met him a couple times before during the campaign, and he's kind of reading the bio, and he's like, I'm telling you right away, I'm going to hire you. I'm going to
waste your time, you know? Spot on impression, by the way. I mean,
he was kind of like, I know you and I've heard about you and I'm impressed with these programs that you've put together. And so then the rest of the interview was just getting to know each other a little bit better. But I think a lot of it was the work that I'd done on the campaign, my past work, and then the relationship that I had with the vice president and then with the president as well.
Question on working for Donald Trump. Mm-hmm. Can you walk through that experience? Obviously, it's an individual that has a big following on one side and a lot of feelings about who he is on the other side.
Right.
In that environment, being close to him and either how the media portrays who he is or who he isn't, talk about his decision making and working with him on some of these really tough issues.
I will tell you that my experience was different. I felt like in the conversations that we had, and we would have a lot of one-on-one conversations, I think people would be really surprised to hear that he was all about people having healthcare. In some ways, I think his administration had to walk him back from maybe where he wanted to go because he was a strong believer in it's terrible that people wouldn't have access to healthcare. He was very concerned about the cost of healthcare because he heard so much about that from ordinary citizens, the deductibles, the copays. And he would always say that to me, Seema, don't forget about the deductibles and the copays. Now, he was not a healthcare policy expert, but he kind of had these parameters. And it's sometimes hard when you're trying to brief somebody that doesn't know all the details of here's Medicaid and here's how it works and things like that. But I also think that that's the job. You have to communicate to the American people, and the American people don't understand all the intricacies. So I feel like we have that understanding about access and affordability. He was incredibly supportive of me. I think there's a lot to be said about people say his treatment of women, this, that, and the other thing, but he was always supportive. My style is a lot of times I'll be quiet. I'll kind of sit in the room and let everybody talk. And he would always seek out my opinion. What do you think? Almost to a point where I felt like if I said something, he trusted me. He trusted my opinion. And that sometimes was daunting to the rest of the team, right? Because they knew if I didn't agree with them and if I'm in the room, he's probably going to go my way. So I generally had a positive experience with him. I also think that one of the things I'm very grateful for was he gave me a long leash. When it came to healthcare, he wasn't afraid of making people angry. He wasn't afraid of the establishment. You know, we sort of talked about disrupting the apple cart, and he didn't care about that. We did some of the things in healthcare that have been out there, policy ideas that have been talked about for years that he did not have a problem with. Price transparency, you know, okay, I don't care if it makes the hospitals mad. Even drug pricing, a lot of these different things where he was not afraid of being disruptive and he didn't hold me back from making the changes that I wanted to make. I'm grateful for the experience that I had, and I'm grateful that he let me do what I thought was right.
Yeah, so it's an extraordinarily complex job. Generally, healthcare, I think at the top is quite male dominated, both as in medicine as well as in public health and government. So two things. One is, what do women bring to it? What did you bring to it? That those thoughts around family, thinking about your kids and being a part of that world and this world as well in a way that only women can be, right? And two, what do you think your kids thought of it? Do you think they'd wish that you'd been at home that whole time, or are they truly just proud of what you
did? That's a good question. I will tell you that I think very little about it. For me, when I went to work every morning, or you're sitting in the Oval Office, really the focus at that moment and at that time is on your job. What are you going to say? What are the arguments going to be? I'm not necessarily looking around the table thinking I'm the only woman here. And I probably was. But I think some of those early experiences, we lived in some small rural towns and you're the only this or the only that, I kind of got used to it. And I really just stopped thinking about it. And I just tried to focus on doing my job. I think the biggest challenge I found as a woman, and I continue to find it, is actually just the temperature in the room. It's always cold, you know, and as a woman, I'm freezing, you know, I'm having to wear pantyhose and a dress and these guys have their suits on. And that to me is the hardest part. I'm like, can we just turn up the temperature? To me, that is a woman friendly environment when the temperature is a little bit higher, but when it's just cold, I feel like I have to do my job. I'm wearing high heels and I'm freezing.
I'm so glad someone said that out loud. Finally, the real challenge.
Yeah.
Well, we have no problem of that here. It's always 1,000 degrees.
Oh, agree to disagree. That's exactly illustrative of what she's saying. No, untrue.
Yeah. So now usually I come into work and I'm probably wearing like 4 or 5 layers that you don't know, because there are these, you know, thin layers, fleece, pantyhose, I mean, all kinds of stuff. But that to me is the biggest challenge.
And your kids, what do you think your kids thought of then?
I don't know that they appreciate what CMS is or what impact the agency has. I think the one thing that they have probably taken from it is the hard work. I think they've always seen me working really hard. And at least my daughter, of course, is pretty turned off to politics. She's also said, I've seen what you go through and I don't want to touch that with a 10-foot pole. My son's a little bit more opposite. He's more interested in politics and in policy. So we'll see. I'm still not that cool in my household. And it's very grounding. You know, you come home and there isn't, oh, you're running an agency. It's like, what's for dinner? What are we doing? Yeah. No one cares, you know, when you come home, which I think is really important. And I'm grateful that my family behaved in that way. They never inflated it at home.
Are they going to become doctors? Are your parents finally going to get the doctors they wanted?
My daughter, ironically, she just graduated from college and her plan is to go to med school. And she actually, one of the minors that she had was in public health, which I thought was kind of interesting.
That's amazing.
Yeah. My son, to be determined, some math, economics, computer science, I don't know. But like I said, he took his first class in health policy and was pretty fascinated.
How do you deal with people labeling you a particular way or disagreeing with the decision you made because they don't have all the facts, they don't have all the context, they don't know what you were weighing back and forth, but they get to make these opinions about you in a public forum? How do you deal with that? Does it get easier over time?
You know what? I've worked with a lot of different governors, obviously worked with the president. I don't think it's easy on anybody. And there's always this initial reaction where it hurts. I think over time, the practice politicians, they kind of learn how to handle it and they don't actually react to it. But I think with everybody I've seen, there's always a little bit of, oh gosh, wow.
Do you remember your first time somebody criticized you publicly?
Gosh, there's so many. I think at some point my staff took my phone and turned off Twitter so I could never read what people were actually saying. Honestly, I think that's important because it makes you stay focused on your work. It's like, this is noise out here. I think a couple of things. Number one, I felt pretty strongly about the policy that we put out. I wasn't putting out something that I could not defend. And I wasn't doing things that I would fight internally. If I didn't like a particular policy, I'm fighting back because ultimately it would be my name on it and I'd have to be the one talking about it. So I tried not to do things that I didn't believe in. And so if people are attacking me on policy, I'm fine with that because I think we have to have active debate about what's good policy. And I think that's important.
Well, I think that's a really good point, too, around having conviction and having a firm stance in what you believe, because then it makes it a little bit easier. It's like, okay, there's differing opinions, but I believe in what I'm pushing forward fully. And so I'll take some of that criticism, but this is the direction we're going.
But just to say, like, you don't have full control, right? I mean, we read through the number of people that you manage. It's something like 106,000 people, 145 million beneficiaries. You don't have full control.
No, you do. Ultimately goes out of the agency. What comes out? Yeah, I mean, you do. You're briefed on every little single thing. And I was very hands-on. So I feel like I was not unaware of what was coming out, or I could say I don't have any responsibility for that. You know, there's a couple of policies where I could say that wasn't my favorite. And those were likely things that were a couple things from the White House where, man, I didn't love that. But even then, you know, I found my way through those policies to be able to say, here's why we're doing it, or here's the background. So I'm not going to say 100%, but I would say most I felt pretty good about, or at least able to explain why. Where I think the line gets it's harder are the personal attacks, the nasty stuff. It's a very takedown type atmosphere, right? Where you disagree with somebody. It's not just a disagreement. They will try to come after you and take your head off. And so that type of nasty stuff where people are trying to portray a narrative about you. And especially being a woman, you can see the undertones of this is blatant sexism here. You wouldn't even bother to make this argument about men. And so those things I think were more painful because they were dirtier, they're below the belt. The good thing is, though, I think everybody sees it. So whoever's doing it, people know what you're doing and why you're doing it, and it makes the other person look bad. It makes it worse than whatever you could possibly say about me. It makes you look worse for even putting these things out there.
How hard was it to always take the high road? Were there times where you're just like, I am going to lay into this person?
Well, there are bullies out there, yeah. Right? So there are bullies. And what I learned through this job was that with bullies, at some point, you try to ration, you try to turn the other cheek, you try to take the high road. But there are times when the only thing you can do with a bully is you got to hit back. And I did have to do that. I had to do that with a bully and I won. And ultimately, then you also set the tone of for all the other bullies out there, don't underestimate me because I will punch back.
That's awesome. Yeah. I would have loved to seen this. Was it very gratifying?
No, I don't take gratification in having to play at that level, right? I mean, that's just not my personality. I don't like to be confrontational. I don't like to fight. But if you have to, then that's what you have to do.
So question going back to healthcare. You look at, this is top of mind because I just watched the movie again, but Too Big to Fail, right? So we had the financial crisis, our banking institutions, too big to fail. Healthcare, massive. And we talked a little bit about like, why is healthcare so complicated? Is healthcare too big to fix?
I was thinking about this the other day that for all of the major pieces of legislation, Republicans and Democrats, right, have we been able to actually change healthcare and change the healthcare experience of people over the last 50, 60 years of legislation and government, I don't want to say interference, but government action? You know, have we really been able to change? And if I think what's changed in healthcare, the technology, the treatments. But what's not changing and arguably actually getting worse is the dysfunction in healthcare. I think I read a survey that people, you know, give the healthcare system a D when it comes to cost and experience, and 74% of people pretty unhappy with the costs and what they're getting. And it's not the doctors, it's not the service necessarily, it's the dysfunction around the system, which I think has actually gotten worse. We're spending, depending on the study you look at, anywhere from 50 to 30% of our healthcare dollar just on administrative costs. And the costs have gotten to the point where it's unsustainable. And it's not just unsustainable in terms of my premium and your premium or our out-of-pocket expenses, our deductibles, but at the highest level, the Medicare program, the trustees have warned, hey, you guys are running out of money, because the idea is that the younger people pay in. It's like a big Ponzi scheme. And that's coming to an end.
Is that coming to an end because there's going to be some forcing function that just forces a big change and it's like the Armageddon of healthcare and then when you have to rebuild everything?
I think the way Medicare is structured, the program is structured through payroll taxes. And at some point, the amount of money that we're spending is more than what's coming in. And that tipping point, it was predicted to be in 2026. Unfortunately, we lost so many seniors to COVID. So now that number is 2028. And both the Part A and the Part B trust funds kind of have these points where they're predicting there won't be enough money. That to me is going to be the clarion call where, okay, either we're going to go into more debt as a country to pay this off, or we're going to start making some more drastic changes to make this work. And it's not just Medicare. I mean, look at Medicaid. Medicaid is the number one budget item in most states, number one or number two. That's where you spend all your money. So that means you're not spending money, climate change, education, infrastructure. So there's a lot of other things that are not happening because healthcare is happening. So for me, I would have to say that was like the overriding issue and what concerned me most about healthcare. And it seems like the solutions that people have are, let's just put more people on government programs. Let's just say, okay, you can't afford healthcare, so we're going to have the government pay for it. Well, that's not a solution. You're just moving it to taxpayers. And if you look at where we are with the deficit, we're in debt. I mean, those are very serious issues for the country. I mean, our deficit continues to go up, and Medicare and Medicaid and these entitlement programs are contributing to it. And going forward, we're adding 10,000 new people to the Medicare program every day. And these are people that have paid into the program their entire lives. So we've made a promise to them to deliver high quality, accessible care. And I think we need to honor that commitment. So we're going to need to start thinking about how health changes, because it's not sustainable the way it's structured today.
I think I saw a stat too that Medicaid enrollment will increase 10 to 15% over the next couple of years in every state. But to take it on the other side and kind of finish towards a positive outcome, what are you most excited about? You're still involved in healthcare. You sit on the board of a number of different companies. What trends are you seeing, or what gets you excited about, okay, we have all these problems, we have some big decisions to make, but here are some shining lights that I think can take us to the next level?
I think a couple of them. Very excited about value-based care, because I think that that to me really changes how we're delivering healthcare on its head, right? It's a fundamental change. Instead of paying for fee-for-service and volume, we're actually paying for quality and outcomes and having a more focus on doing the right thing for the patient, but also trying to keep costs low. So I'm excited about that. And, you know, it's taken a while. Value-based care also allows us to do things like address the social determinants of health. You know, that's been an issue.
I've heard of that.
Yeah, you heard of that? You guys play a big role, but that's a great example of, that's not a new concept, right? It's been out there. I think I wrote my paper in my when I was doing my degree around primary care and social determinants of health. Nobody did anything about it. During our administration, we said, look, we're going to allow Medicare Advantage plans to offer the benefits that they think are going to improve the health of the individual, whether that's food or transportation or whatever social service they potentially need. I think those things were really important. And the focus on that, I think, may give us an opportunity, not just to lower costs, but actually improve outcomes and make a difference in people's lives in a way that we haven't before.
And that was a big policy shift. Big kudos to you, because I don't think it gets enough attention. Because when you talk about value-based payment, again, a lot of people listening here, sometimes that's just going to go right over their head. Like, what in the world does that mean? But literally what you put in place was the ability to pay for food or transportation, the other factors that influence someone's overall health and well-being. And that didn't really exist before. And so now you start to see traditional healthcare thinking outside of traditional clinical responses to some of those other factors that are either going to allow that individual to become healthier or better manage polychronic issues and things of that nature. And from a policy shift perspective, monumental, especially in our world. And I think that is something that we want to continue to see move on. Thank you so much for spending time with us today. What can people expect out of Seema Verma moving forward? Where are they going to find you? What are you doing? When's the book coming out? The Lifetime
going
movie?
Going back to med school finally, maybe.
Yeah, not going to med school, not writing a tell-all book. You know, I'm telling people right now, I'm in the dating phase. It's been fascinating. I'm working with TPG and Cressy. And what I'm enjoying is that I'm getting to see a different side of the healthcare market that I hadn't always appreciated. And also understanding, here's government regulations, and then here's what happens in the private sector, and kind of understanding sometimes the government has the vision or the direction, but it can take many years for those things to actually come in place. So I'm having a really good time, but I feel like I'm in the dating phase, right? Where I'm just kind of looking around and talking to a bunch of stuff, haven't quite seen exactly what I want to do. But I want to be in a place where company is an innovator who's thinking about doing things differently. I'm not one to run the trains and make sure the trains are getting there on time. I'm probably that person that's going to figure out where the train needs to go and lay the new tracks. So still haven't found the right place.
Is it technology, you think? Is that what's going to change healthcare ultimately? And
I think technology is super important, whereas there's a lot of poo-pooing the technology giants that are wanting to come into healthcare. I'm glad they are. I'm glad that we have new people that are trying to come in and figure out how to do things differently. You know, if I have to go to another doctor's office and fill out a form on paper, I'm going to scream. And I'm tired of filling that out over and over again. We had a big focus on innovation at CMS because I was not about rationing healthcare benefits. I wanted to deliver on the promise to people that have paid into the program their whole lives. And so how do we do it better? How do we do healthcare better, faster, quicker, cheaper? I think technology is going to help us. It's not the end-all solution, but boy, it plays a big role. If you can have access to your health record wherever you go, take it with you. If you have information on price and quality, we're igniting kind of a new, enlightened healthcare consumer. And I think technology is going to deliver a lot of different solutions. So I'm excited. I'm glad these tech giants are involving themselves. And I appreciate that they are getting into something that's complicated. And yeah, they're probably going to stumble here and there. But I think we need the greatest minds in our country to figure out this problem, which is very complex.
Well, again, Seema, I can't thank you enough for the time today, giving us your wisdom. I think you're going to have a million different options to consider based on your philosophy, who you are, your vision, and your expertise in the space. I'm very excited to see what you do next because I know it's going to be super impactful. So thank you for joining us today.
Thanks for joining us.
Hey team, thanks for tuning in today. We want your feedback. Who should we talk to next? What questions should we ask? And what do you want to get out of this podcast? How can we get better?
Email us at podcast@uniteus.com. Let Taylor and I know what you think, and we'll see you next time.